is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. At the age of 21, my next guest was a successful model. He weighed 180 pounds. 6 months later, he was 70 pounds heavier. His modeling career effectively ended. Ron Saxon tells his story in a new memoir, The Good Eater, the true story of one man's struggle with binge eating disorder. It is a compelling book written by the Berkeley, California resident who joins me from here in Vancouver, published by New Harbinger. The book retails for $31.95. He's been on everything for this book, CNN, Good Morning America, NPR, the CBC, and others. It's also been written up in Newsweek, so he doesn't need to be on with us, but I'm happy to have him nonetheless. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Ron Saxon. Good morning, Mr. Saxon.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. How many people in the United States and in Canada have binge eating disorder?
The numbers are probably around in the, I would say, in the 5 million range. There was a study that just came out from Harvard about 3 months ago, and it named binge eating disorder in North America the number one eating disorder, outnumbering anorexia and bulimia combined. And the big thing for me, being a guy, is that while bulimia and anorexia are about 10 to 15% male, binge eating disorder is 40% male.
And I guess this is the publicity around the book says that you're the first to write a book from a male perspective on this disorder, correct?
Correct.
Do you find that there are people like, I mean, I guess through your treatment or so on, or overcoming this disorder, have you met a lot of men that have this?
Yeah, I have met a few men, but not too many really, because the men, you know, one of the things, I had it for a long time, and I knew I had a problem, and I was just hoping on hope that I could somehow just get over it somehow, buck up, be strong, and of course, until you actually deal with the problem that got you there and put the disorder out of business, you know, you're always going to go back. And so, you know, men are horrible about stepping up. There's many treatment centers around North America for women, inpatient facilities for women. And when I talk to people about why there isn't as many services for men, it's because they say that, you know, men just don't come forward, and it's true. As I've traveled around and had discussions, more often than not, it's the girlfriends and the wives that show up to talk about their men. And I've had many emails from men saying, okay, I know you're going to appear at this thing, but, and I identify with you, and I appreciate you coming out, but I don't want to show up at your function, because if I do, what's that say about me? And I understand that, because even now when I talk to men about it face-to-face who don't have, never had an eating disorder, I know I get the look like, okay, that's a woman's thing, so if you've got this woman's thing, are you gay or what? And you have to start that explaining thing. But yeah, it's kind of sad, and that's kind of part of the reason, or one of the big takeaways to write the book was that I knew there was people like me, men like me out there suffering in silence who were putting it off like I was, and they needed, like I did, to begin their journey to getting better.
Now, you mentioned that usually the wives or girlfriends of these men who have this disease are the ones who know the signs and who go to get help. In your case, there wasn't a woman in your life early on, correct?
No, there wasn't. And one of the things about binge eating disorder is that it's pretty easy to hide, and I kept it hidden. Nobody knew. Even when I wrote the book, my family, we weren't really a close family, so it's not surprising. They were like, you what? And so, yeah, way back when I was suffering, I didn't have really anybody to confide in. It wasn't until, and part of my recovery was the fact that I could find someone, my current wife, who I married and spent my honeymoon in Victoria last October, you know, and she was there for me. But way back through all those years there, I was by myself. And I thought I was peculiar, that this thing that I did not understand, that I was embarrassed about, that it was just me, and that I wasn't about to talk about it because I didn't understand it and I was embarrassed. But when I discovered that, you know, I wasn't alone, I wasn't a party of one, I was a party of millions, it made all the difference in the world.
How old were you when you discovered this? And I guess it's the question, how did you know that you had this disorder compared to, you knew growing up you were a healthy eater?
Well, you know, in the book I talk about my first disordered eating act, and I certainly didn't have binge eating disorder back then with the age of 11, but I used food as my way to numb myself out so I wouldn't have to feel anxiety. It was my way to escape, and when you learn to do that at a very early age and you keep doing that, unlike most people who say, should I go left, should I go right, if I got a problem with Joe, you and I are going to talk it out and we'll get to the solution. Instead, you know, because I developed that early on, because of my chaotic childhood, I use food, you know, as a way to numb myself out and to not feel. But it wasn't until the age of 19, when I had gone from disordered eating acts to a full-blown disorder, that I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I didn't know anybody like me, never heard of anybody like me, and that I should step forward and talk to a therapist or somebody about my problem, because this isn't anything I've ever heard of. And that was at 19. It wasn't until much later in my late 30s that I actually really discovered that there was a name for my pain, and that was called BED, binge eating disorder.
When you were growing up, you talked about having a chaotic childhood. You used food as an escape, as a comfort.
Yep.
People like, you know, most people, they have, you know, a big meal at Thanksgiving or Christmas or you know, on summer holidays.
Sure.
Or something, and they do it as a sort of, you know, because they're happy, they're with family.
Yeah.
Etc. Was yours different, that you ate because you were depressed or sad, or I guess you were in fear of your father, correct?
Yeah, I mean, what I talk about in the book is, you know, my dad's discipline was way over the top. It would be child abuse. My dad's alive. My publisher was wishing he was dead, because dead people can't sue. But my dad's read the book and signed off on it. It's all true and everything. But he had a job, or he had owned a business where he wouldn't come home until after we went to bed. But my mom would keep a notepad of what we did wrong. And sometimes she would say, okay, I'm sick of what you've been doing. You haven't taken out the garbage on time, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to give this to your father when he comes home. And he would wake us up at 10 o'clock at night to whip us. Didn't always do it, though. And so this one particular night that I mentioned in the book, you know, I'm sitting there, it's 9:30 at night, I'm 11 years old, sweaty feet, sweaty palms, because I know that what's going to happen, it's going to hurt like crazy. There's always a candy sale going on every year, which the Saxon boys took part in, and we always won the contest because we were little selling machines. And I had about 20 pounds of chocolate in the closet. So I made, for some reason, I went and I grabbed a 5-ounce candy bar and I ate it. While I ate it, it took me away. Of course, when the candy bar is gone, which doesn't take long, reality comes back. So the whole night I would keep going back and back until I'd eat about 3 pounds of chocolate. Now, all that sugar knocked me out, and the next morning I woke up and my dad hadn't whipped me, which had nothing to do with the chocolate. But I had learned an important lesson, and that was that food could temporarily numb me out so I didn't have to feel. And, you know, as time went on, it got worse and worse. It wasn't a matter of, you know, picking out at Thanksgiving, which is, why not, let's do that. It developed into a situation where I had no control. When anxiety would come or whatever trigger would set me into a binge, I would dread it, I would fight it, and in 15 years of hardcore BED, I never won one time. And when I would lose it, I would usually, like I say, write myself a permission slip. I'd tell myself, to drink tomorrow, I'll be good for the rest of my life. That was kind of my excuse to go ahead and party, and that was a way for me to not feel so bad about what I was about to do. And what I would do is I would go to a drive-thru, because it usually happened towards evening time, and I would get 2 Big Macs, large orders of fry, a chocolate shake, and I would eat that. And then as soon as I left the drive-thru McDonald's, I'm on my way to Taco Bell, and sometimes I would show up at the Taco Bell, and I hadn't even finished my McDonald's yet. Sometimes I'd pull my coat over the food because I didn't want the guy in drive-thru to say, excuse me, you got like food sitting there on the passenger side.
Right.
And I would go from drive-thru to drive-thru, and I would stop at a convenience store and buy 3 or 4 king-size candy bars. And I would continue that, even though I was full as full can be, until I could physically not put one more bite in. And then, because when you do that at the end, when the binge is done, then reality comes back and there's no more drug. It's like an alcoholic who's drunk, you know, when you're drunk, you escape, and when the alcohol wears off, you're back facing reality. And so, for me, at the age of 19, that's the kind of life I was living, and for me, it was the last thing I thought about when I went to bed at night, and the first thing I thought about in the morning, and all I thought about all day was food, and I'm scared I'm going to binge, and I'm getting fat, and blah, 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 blah. So that's the difference.
Throughout that time, was there any point when you're eating, you know, a nice meal or something, that you would enjoy the food?
Boy, you know, I tell you, part of the binge, you try to have the best binge you could possibly have. But whenever I was eating, I'd say from 16 to my late 30s, I was always like, yeah, I'm enjoying it, but I'm worried that I won't stop soon enough, or I should only eat half about what I'm going to eat because, you know, I need to lose weight because I'm 50 pounds overweight, or I'm 100 pounds overweight, or I'm 120 pounds overweight. So it was always, you know, there was never a chance to catch my breath. My weight was always going up or going down in a, you know, in a 100-pound swing. And, yeah, there was, you know, I could enjoy the food, but I was always afraid that I would go too far.
One of the things, in the interesting things in the book that I took to when I read it was there were some moments when you had some sort of, I guess, I don't know how to put it, that almost nearly tender moment with your father, and that'd revolve around food. He'd almost challenge you or have a contest with you who could finish their meal, and by his approval, I guess, that meant something to you.
Yeah, I mean, the book's called The Good Eater because I was called The Good Eater. And my family was chaotic, and so you give anybody something that they think will please the prison guards, so to speak, and they will latch on to it. One of the things I latched on to was that I found that, you know, kids don't always finish their food, and sometimes kids are picky eaters, and I was never one of those. To this day, my mom says there was never a time that she could ever remember that I did not finish my food. And so that became the thing. And also, you know, my dad was actually tough guy, but he's also a funny guy. He could tell a good joke, spin some good yarn, and I kind of got my sense of humor from him. So what I always thought was that as long as a family's smiling or laughing, bad things can't happen. So for me, being the good eater and trying to be humorous was the two things I tried to use to keep the family calmer.
Now, your father left your family, correct?
Yeah.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 16. I had two younger sisters, two older brothers, and we were a very, very fundamentalist, over-the-top religious family, and my dad called in sick. My dad never called in sick. I mean, he didn't call it sick, but he never was sick. He always said that being sick was a state of mind. If you just thought hard enough, you'd never be sick. I just think he had a strong constitution. But he, you know, stayed home from church, and we went off to church, and we came home, and there was a note, and he had left us. He had had secret relationships with women behind my mother's back and our back, and he was gone. So even though having him gone was you would think I'd be celebrating, and the kids would be celebrating because here's this disciplinarian. But, you know, we also respected him. He was a funny guy, a strong man, a good breadwinner, and so we also were bummed out that our family unit was broken, and that, you know, other people would look at us like, oh, there's the Saxon family. Look what happened to them.
His departure, though, what did that mean for your disorder?
Well, for me, it kind of was like shock therapy. It made turned my world upside down. And, you know, at that point, I wasn't really, you know, the disordered eating acts were increasing, but wasn't quite full-blown yet. But not long after that, you know, at that age, your kid's going, a boy's going through hormones, and he wants to get the girl, and I was one of those guys that was afraid because I was kind of the chunky guy that I'd go my whole life and never kiss a girl. And so not long after he left, I went on my first diet. To get the weight off so I could get the girl. And I did it pretty well. Looking back, I don't think I was unhealthy in the way I did it, and I got the weight off for the first time about the age of 17 and got my first girlfriend actually at the age of 18. But it was to be short-lived because as soon as my senior year in high school was over, I went off to college, so all that kind of pressure was kind of a breeding ground for my disorder, and that's when it really kicked in. I was going to school full-time, working full-time, didn't have really any spare money, was just tired, working 40 hours a week, going to school 40 hours a week, and it just, you know, food was like the only thing I had that I could really enjoy, and then the enjoyment factor of it, and then plus just being tired and depressed about, you know, not having a girl and all that good stuff, it just, the weight all came pouring back on and more, which kind of feeds upon itself, you know, it becomes a trigger because you're bummed out about your weight and all that good stuff, and so it just, it took off, and then really that after that first year of college, things really heated up, and they were to heat up for the next bunch of years to come.
I wanted to go into modeling, but I wanted to go back to sort of what BED is. Mm-hmm. And we hear a lot about obesity being an epidemic not only in this
sure.
country but in your country, in the United States. Is there a connection between being obese and having this disorder?
Yeah, well, it, certainly, if you... You know, anorexia, you starve yourself, you know what that looks like, and bulimia, you binge like I did, but then you throw up,
or you use exercise abuse to get the weight off. I did that a little bit. But with binge eating disorder, you eat a bunch of food and you don't get rid of it, so you are going to be obese. So if you have BED, you're going to be obese. And but certainly, being obese does not, you know, if you have it, doesn't mean you have binge eating disorder. And, you know, there's certainly, there's degrees. The psychology world has a manual called the DSM-4, and they have a, they say, okay, here's the cutoff for BED. You have to binge uncontrollably, and you're ashamed of it, at least twice a week for 6 months. That's BED. Now, that's an artificial thing, because they just had to have a cutoff for the medical journals. But certainly, when I was 11, I didn't qualify. When I was 19, I did. But certainly, being obese and BED go hand in hand, because if you got it, you're going to be obese. And the problem with, here's a big deal. People can get over BED and not binge anymore and deal with life instead of trying to escape from anxiety like I did, face it head on, instead of, you know, hiding behind food or alcohol or whatever. But the problem is that we're still going to be left with obesity. We're going to be like myself, you know, overweight, but still not, you know, have, you know, official BED. The problem is we don't want to be overweight, because who wants to be? And that fact and trying to lose the weight, going hungry and all that good stuff and being depressed about being overweight can send you back where you came from and can lead back to binging. So hopefully that answers the question.
I'm talking with Ron Saxon. The book is called The Good Eater, 3195 from New Harbinger. How did you get into modeling and why?
Yeah, it was very crazy, because you can have anorexia and bulimia and all that good stuff and survive as a model, but you're not going to do it with BED. What I would do is some days when I would say, I'll be good for the rest of my life, I would be good for a while, and I would arrest the behavior with good old willpower, which is a fleeting thing. And one of the times when I yo-yoing down, people said, are you a model? I thought, are you kidding me? I haven't had a date in 2 years. I'm a 21-year-old virgin. I don't want to be. I don't think so. And I heard that enough, and I thought, could I be a model, this guy, this fat kid, this kid? So I went down to a bookstore, and I saw a book on male models, kind of a beefcake book. It listed the height and weight, and I was 20 pounds off. So I did what I shouldn't do, worked out for 4 hours a day, lived off 1,000 calories. I made the weight, signed the contract. And I thought, by signing the contract and becoming a male model, I could get the girl, and I did. And my life could be made, and I could be so happy that this thing that I did not understand, this thing that I was embarrassed about and ashamed about, I could push it aside, and just the sheer fact that I'm happy would just make it go away. And of course it did, because no sooner did I sign the contract and start working that I would do a fashion show, and I'd find myself 3 days later binging for no apparent reason, because anxiety, good or bad, would set me off. Then I'd go, oh my God, I'd go run 15 miles, and then I'd do Beyond TV, and then, you know, sometimes 4 hours later, there I am doing it again. And so, you know, after I got out of modeling, because I had to, because like you said in the intro, I had got selected for a couple fashion shows. One of them was men's underwear, and the guy said, you need to lose 5 pounds because you're going to be in your underwear. At that time, I was just tired of it. And instead of doing that, I went off on a massive binge, and it never ended until I gained 70 pounds in 6 months. But I would end up walking into a bookstore, and there's this book by Random House called Sports Fitness and Training, and I'm the guy on the cover at 180 pounds, and I'm the good-looking guy that says, you know, if you want to look like this guy, buy the book. Well, when that book hit the newsstands, you know, I would walk into the bookstore at 300 pounds and look at the 180-pound guy and say, what happened to me? But the truth of the matter is, we were both the same. That 180-pound guy staring at me from the bookshelf was the same as a 300-pound guy. We both had a problem. We both hadn't taken care of it, and we were both out of control. Just one of us, you know, was at our thin time. One of us was at our heavy time.
Someone you talk about in the book is Wade Ashford.
Yep.
What role did he play in your life?
Well, Wade Ashford was a person that I had, had met after the modeling. But he introduced me to methamphetamine. He was a person that I knew from my past, from when I was younger, and it was a happenstance that I ran into him. But, you know, his role was that he introduced me to methamphetamine, and methamphetamine is a horrible drug, and I was doing it back in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, and actually 87. Anyway. And, you know, I, I did it because he was like, you know, have you done this drug before? And, you know, I did it for the wrong reasons. I mean, I got peer pressured into it, which is stupid. And then I told myself that I would use this drug to lose weight, because he told me, hey, you know, methamphetamine, you can take this drug, you'll have all kinds of energy, and you can lose weight. And so I convinced myself that I would use it only for medical purposes. So I got to where I started actually smoking methamphetamine every morning, like a cup of coffee. Of course, you know, I don't care, you know, who you think you are. If you do methamphetamine long enough, it will ruin your life or cause problems, and it did for me too. But and fortunately for me, you know, I had a bad episode, and I was able to move on from that. But it took a while. I mean, methamphetamine, you know, it worked there for a while, you know, just. But eventually it backfired, and luckily for me, and not for him, I was able to get over it and move on. But for him, it would go on to really inflict some heavy damage on his life.
Now, overcoming the drug abuse, overcoming the disorder, which came first, and did they sort of go hand in hand?
Well, the disorder, I overcame that after the drugs. But yeah, the hand in hand, I mean, it was the... You know, they both were tied, the drugs were tied into me trying to overcome, me thinking that if I could just get back, because when I did the drugs, my modeling career was already gone. And, of course, the bad thing for me was I had these permanent examples in magazines and in the book and other stuff of me when I thought I looked perfect. I thought I was the good Ron. And so for me, the drugs was my way to hopefully get back afterwards. But... you know, it's you know, kind of like the food, using the food as a tool to evade anxiety and facing reality with a drug. I mean, the drugs were like a drug too, and but yeah, the drugs were after the modeling, but before getting better. And you know, and part of you know people, you know, I hit the bottom, and the bottom can be a very empowering place, and for me it was. I hit the bottom and chose to get better. But yeah, part of the drug was part of that, you know, my traveling to the bottom.
When you look at in the book, there are a lot of photos from your modeling career. When you look at that today, how does it when you were of large weight in the past, it obviously affected you. When you see these pictures today, what's your reaction to them? Are you proud?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, you look at it differently. I spent, after my modeling years were over, which was back in 1984, you know, I really, you know, fought with binge eating disorder and was obese for the, you know, in various degrees for the next 20 years, which would take you to 2004. And so in 2004, when I was maybe 80 pounds, more than when I was a model, I would look back at that and say, okay, I'm better with this binging thing, but I really do wish I was thin. But I also knew that guy in those pictures was one messed up dude who wasn't happy, who was afraid to death that one day he would screw up and lose what he had. And of course, I was right. I screwed up and I lost what I had. So I, you know, up until 2004, if I look at those pictures, I probably would still have some wishing that I could somehow get back there. Of course, right now, in 2007, I'm back. And one of the things, again, conquering the binge eating disorder and then conquering obesity is two separate things. You can be, of course, obese and not have binge eating disorder because, you know, most people would rather eat a pizza than do a push-up, me included. But in the last couple of years, I've made a concerted effort. You know, I've got a cardiologist who wanted me to lose weight. I've got bad knees that want me to lose weight. I've got a wife who wants me to lose weight. And I thought, okay, can I do it this time the right way, the healthy way, you know, and, you know, eating properly, exercising properly, not over-exercising, not over-dieting. And I have. And right now I'm probably about 10 pounds more than when I modeled. When I modeled, I was a bit too thin because I'm kind of a big bone guy. And for me, 6'1", 180 is kind of low. Probably a little better off at 6'1", 190, which is where I am now. So now when I look at those pictures, it's pretty easy to be okay with it because that guy back then when he was a model was thin and messed up, and now I feel like I'm at the proper weight, but I'm not messed up, so I feel pretty good about it now. But you asked me in 2004 what I would have felt, and I probably would have been a little jealous of that guy that I couldn't, you know, be better, but, you know, be that guy's weight.
He used words like conquering and overcoming binge eating disorder. Is one ever cured of it?
It's a great, fantastic question, and I think everybody can answer it their own way. Most people answer it and say that you can never conquer it, that you're always recovering, and that's the boat I'm in. There's a few people that I know that say they believe that they can be fully recovered, but these people, this one lady who was anorexic, she hasn't been anorexic for 30 years, so maybe if you haven't done something for 30 years, you can feel pretty confident in being recovered. But I believe in recovering, just like with alcoholism. I think if you've crossed a line of behavior 1,000 times, to tell yourself that I will never do it 1,001th time, I think you got to be pretty cocky. And maybe I feel like I'm never going to go back. I feel pretty confident in that. I think part of it is believing that you're always recovering, that you can slip, and part of it is not wanting to jinx myself by saying, "Oh, I'll never do that." You know, pride goeth before a fall. But I believe in that you're always recovering, that that you can be better and better and better, and that you may never go back. But I think you always need to be vigilant, because it's pretty easy for me. You get a lot of stress in your life, bad things happen, and then we'll see how good you are. You know, one of the proofs that I know that I'm better is because the old Ron developed a real big stage fright, would be afraid to do this interview with you today, would be afraid to be on TV on Good Morning America and stuff like that. The old Ron would have binged so he wouldn't have to feel the anxiety about being nervous about talking to you. But one of the big tests is all that I've had to do with the book. Because when I wrote the book, started writing the book a few years back, I remember thinking, you know, what if I sell it, and then what if they make me talk about it? That is big, you know, big time trigger central. And so far, you know, knock on wood or whatever, I've been fine, and it's been a real big test that I've enjoyed passing.
It's one of those, it's like the drug addict or the alcoholic, you take it one day at a time, do you?
Yeah, yes, I mean, I feel like I don't wake up every day afraid, like, oh my God, I did it good yesterday, can I do it again today? But I'm always vigilant, I'm always watching, I'm never not aware of it. It may get to where you barely think about it on a super, super low level, but it's always there.
There's more I wanted to ask you about the book, but I realized I've kept you longer than I should. But I wanted to mention your marriages. I wanted to mention how you met your wife, Leslie. But the one thing that I think we should close on, and I think would be important because I brought it up earlier, is this relationship with your father. You talked about him being an abusive father in the book and in the interview. What's your relationship like with your family today?
Surprisingly, my relationship with my father is the best it's ever been in my entire life, and I am shocked. You know, I was afraid for him to see what I wrote because I wrote it honestly. I pulled some punches, but not too many. But you know, he said that's the truth. That's what happened, and I don't no excuses for me. You know, I didn't want to do what I did, but I did it anyway, and I know better. So my relationship with my father I wouldn't call it one of these lovey-dovey relationships because that's not the kind of family we had, but it's the best it's ever been. My sister Robin we're two peas in a pod. I got other brothers and sisters, and I have one sister I really don't talk to. My mother, I don't talk to. I haven't talked to in probably 2 years, and that's because it's kind of a long story, but there's this fundamentalist religion that we belong to, and my sister Robin, who I love dearly, is gay and has come out of the closet, and my mom fails to recognize her and thinks that she's this horrible, disgusting human being, and me and my little sister are both two crazy, wonderful people. We both did stand-up comedy, which should say enough, and so that's something I can't live with, that someone would think so little of someone I love so much. But the surprising thing is my father, and I mentioned that in the acknowledgement. I praise him for embracing the past. There can be a future, but it's been a wonderful surprise.
Well, Ron, thanks so much for joining us today. It is a fascinating and compelling book, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks for having me on.